I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm amazed how many people own stocks. They would not be able to tell you why they own them. They couldn't say in a minute or less why they own it. Actually, you really press them down, they'd say, the reason I own this is the sucker's going up.
There's enough cash in the financial system, and there is an infinite amount of cash at the Federal Reserve, an infinite amount of cash.
Put that check in a money market mutual fund. Then we'll reinvest the earnings into foreign currency accounts with compounding interest, and it's gone.
So they had to do something. All they had left was just to print money and start buying things. And that's what they did.
Quick buck artists come and go with every bull market, but the steady players make it through the bear market.
They say money can't buy happiness. Look at the fucking smile on my face.
Hello and welcome to Market Makers, the number one Swedish investing podcast on tech and growth stocks. Normally, we host this show in Swedish, of course, but since we have a very special guest for you this Christmas Eve, we decided to release an English version as well. But if you speak Swedish, I would recommend tuning into the regular episode 163. And for all of the English-speaking listeners, we welcome you to an hour of trading insights and lessons with Mr. Jack Schwager himself.
Jack Schwager is probably best known for his best-selling Market Wizards series, now with a new installment, Unknown Market Wizards. Mr. Schwager is also co-founder and chief research officer at FundSider.com, a firm that seeks to find undiscovered trading talent worldwide. He is also a frequent seminar speaker and lecturer in a wide range of topics, from characteristics of great traders to technical analysis and investment fallacies.
Before we get started, we would like to extend a big thanks to Nordic Auto Trading Society and AutoStock for making this interview possible. We also want to remind all of our listeners that this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as basis for investment decisions. Now, over to Mr. Jack Schwager. So, welcome to the show, Jack Schwager. For those of our listeners that haven't read your books or heard about you, can you give us a brief background on you and your book series?
Yeah, sure. So, what I'm best known for is, I've written about a dozen books. The ones I'm best known for, though, is the Market Wizard series, which is a series of books, the first of which, the first one, I didn't know it was going to be a series, but the first one was 1989, and the most recent one just came out November. And they're basically books where I interview great traders, in most cases, traders that are very well known. In this particular, in every book though, not in every book, but in most books, I've also had people which were not known, but this book was totally focused on what I, well, as the title suggests, unknown market wizards. And the idea is to speak to the people who have succeeded extraordinarily well in the markets for long periods of time, and to try to learn from them what they do and how they think and what their experiences was and what lessons they have for the rest of us, etc.
So what made you interested in trading and how did you get started?
Basically fell into it. I'm not one of these people who had an ambition to be a trader or had any thoughts of a career related to markets or anything like that. I was basically just coming out of graduate school for an economics degree and was looking for an analytical job. And it so happened that the first job that I found was an analyst position for a futures analyst position. Ironically, as it would turn out, the position that I was taking was being vacated by a fellow called Michael Marcus, who in later years ended up being the first chapter of the first Market Wizards book. Oh, so yes, the original question, I got interested in trading. So by virtue of becoming an analyst in markets, I mean, once your job is analyzing markets and making recommendations, it's a very short step to, you know, doing it yourself.
And how do you find these traders, the market wizards? It feels like especially the unknown ones must be very hard to find.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the unknown ones. I mean, this most recent one. I basically had three ways I found these people. One is, I'm also involved with a startup, you know, on the bio. I only talked about the books. I've done lots of other things. But currently, I'm also involved with a startup called FunSeeder.com, which is basically a platform for traders providing free analytics on performance analytics and stuff like that. The idea of our purpose of providing that is not to, you know, we're not a charity for traders, but the idea was to start to have this site which would draw traders to it and build a database of hopefully superior traders. We assumed that the underlying assumption of the whole company was there's probably lots of traders worldwide who are extremely good, but nobody knows who they are. They don't manage any money. They're just trading their own account quite happily. They'll never have a chance to manage any money because they don't have the right pedigree. They're not in the right country or whatever. So this was a way of finding undiscovered trading talent. So actually, a number of traders in this book did come from FunSeeder. I also personally knew some of the traders. The chapter one, in fact, a fellow by the name of Peter Brandt, who is actually a friend, and I've always admired his perspectives on markets and wanted to immortalize it in a book. And so I knew him. There were two other traders who had reached out to me in the year prior to my writing this book, for other reasons not related to the book. But I knew of them through that. And then, so again, I knew them. And I knew through meeting them for other purposes that they had extraordinary backgrounds as traders. And so that was a second source. And the third one is I just used my Twitter account to say, hey, I'm doing a book on great trade, on undiscovered great traders. If you know anybody who who has a superior record of at least 10 years, exceptional record or whatever word I use, but superior isn't strong enough of a word, let me know. Or if you are one, let me know. And I got many hundreds of responses.
So could you share with us some of the probably the most surprising stories?
Yeah, because in your new book, you have many maybe unlikely characters who became successes. You had Jason Shapiro, who blew up his million-dollar account multiple times, a guy trading through social media. You have a bellhop in Czechoslovakia who's day trading stocks. You have a tennis player. You know, you have Peter Brandt.
Yeah.
What do these people have in common that makes them stock market wizards?
Well, first of all, it's not the methodology, because people you're referring to have totally, totally different methodologies. So that's certainly not it. One thing they all shared is they have very good risk management processes. I would say with one exception in his book, risk management is an extraordinarily critical part of their approach. In the other case, the person basically knows when it'll get out. It's based upon his methodology. So it's not so much he doesn't have a risk methodology where he will, you know, risk a certain amount to get out, but he knows when the reason for this being in a trade is no longer valid or it becomes known, then he'll get out. So he still has a process, but that's probably the most common denominator. They tend to be pretty obsessive about what they do. I would say that's true of an awful lot of people in this book and probably market wizards in general. So literally just extreme devotion to developing their approach and, you know, spending many, many hours and tremendous preparation and discipline and so forth. So it's not a casual thing, you know. These traders aren't traders who just kind of sit at, you know, look at the screen and say, oh, I'm going to buy this, I'm going to sell that, you know. They've really done a lot of preparation and work behind the trades.
If we switch perspective and look at, have you met some awful traders? And do you see any defining traits for what makes a bad trader?
Oh, sure. And I often ask, and you know, it's not so much I meet awful traders. It's, most people aren't good traders, you know, if they're just ordinary people. But I ask the people I interview a lot of times what their experience is with people who, what's the difference between, you know, winning and losing? You know, what characteristics losing traders share? And I also have my own perspectives, but there's lots of things. So, I mean, this is only in like a very partial list. Typically, they don't have a good risk management process. That's probably the most common reason traders fail. Losing traders let their emotions get in the way. They take trades on impulse. They'll do stupid stuff like they'll take a trade on impulse. Well, of course, if you've got an impulse to take the trade and you're really not skilled, so do lots of other people, and you're probably buying the high and selling the low. You know, because if you feel panic or you feel euphoria, that's because something happened in the market which a lot of other people are reacting to. And those are not the people making the money. You know, the people making the money are already in the trade or they're going the other way. So that emotional aspect. And emotional aspect manifests itself in lots of ways. Like one good example comes up in this Unknown Market Wizards book with one of the traders who's not a losing trader, obviously, but in his earlier days, before he became a really good trader, had a perfect example of what I would call a revenge trade, which is a typical kind of thing a bad trader would do. So, and that is, people who lose money in a trade or a market will have a tendency to want to make the money back, but not just make it back, but make it back in the same market. It's like the show, you market, you don't understand, I was right, you were wrong, and I'm going to show you, I'm going to get the money back. You know, it's that type of reaction. And all those types of emotional reactions are just wrong, and they contribute to people losing. But like in this particular case, this trader had learned a little of the craft and had developed a methodology and had made like 60 or 70% over the course of a year. He had a trade. The second Iraq War. I forget which, but it was some announcement which came out, which should have. I don't remember exactly what the trigger was, but it should have been a bullish. It should have been a bearish thing for the market, right? Like the beginning of a war or something like that. And he was short, you know, and the market went down initially. He added more, but then he got stopped out, and so. It's just that the market has to go down on this. And so he kept on shorting, he kept on getting stopped out. He had stops, but he kept on getting stopped out. So he did this 5 times during the same day, trying to make the money back in the same market. And by the end of the day, he had wiped out his profits for the year. So that's a good example of what losing traders do. They let their emotions dominate what they're doing. People who win basically are very calm, centered, focused, unemotional.
It sounds like this, that you don't believe that everybody can be a good trader. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, people can improve, not to sell my books. I mean, I believe if you read any of the Market Wizards series or all of them or whatever, I think if you read it and were open-minded and took some of the lessons, that you'd be better off. You'd even at the least you'd lose less money. Hopefully, you'd if you're losing, you'd become a winner, a net winner, and if you're winning, maybe you'd win more. But you know, I don't make pretense. I mean, and some people, a number of people in this book read my original book. So some people do become market wizards, right? So I mean, that's a possibility, but it's not. It's only going to be in minorities. That's like saying if you're a great basketball coach and put out a video on how to play, you know, another thing you have to do right for basketball, maybe people watch it and they become better at the game, you know, playing, but it's ridiculous to expect most of them, or forget most of them, for any meaningful number to become professional, right? It's only a small number of people have the skill to be exceptional in any field, and trading is the same. So yeah, I only think a small percentage of people have whatever it is, the inner personality, character, skills, whatever, to be great traders. But I think most people can become at least probably net profitable if they apply all the right lessons.
I listened to an old interview of yours where you, I forgot who you quoted, but you said human nature is so poorly attuned to trading that most people do worse than random. Why is that?
Yeah, so that first of all, I was quoting Bill Eckhart. Yeah, who said, like you say, our human, his point was that we have evolved to be, through evolution, we've evolved to seek comfort. You know, humans seek comfort. That's just, shelter, warm food, sex, anything. And it's always seeking comfort, right? And those natural instincts to do what's comfortable do not work in the markets. The markets don't pay anybody to be comfortable. On the contrary, and I'll get to the worst in random. So, but an example of seeking comfort would be, let's say you have a law. Let's say the market, you're long. The market goes down. It's not acting the way you think it should have. You say, well, okay, I probably should get out, but I'm down now. I'll get out in the first up day. You know, or I'll get out when I'm even. You sort of that type of thing. And then when you make that decision, you feel no relief because, well, you got hope. Maybe tomorrow the market will be up and I'll do better getting out than today. That feels comfortable. So that's an example. I give you lots of examples. But those type of decisions that make people feel better are usually the wrong decisions. Now, what Eckhart was saying is that humans are so poor, our inner nature, the way we have evolved, is so poorly attuned to making correct decisions in the markets that most people will do worse than random. And the emphasis here is on worse than random. So he's not merely saying, like the popular thing about, well, you could take a monkey and have the monkey throw darts at the Wall Street quote page, stock page, and the picks, those darts will do, the monkey will do better as well, not better. The monkey will do as well as professional money managers. So, he's not saying that. He's saying the monkey will do better because the monkey is uninhibited by these natural human emotions. That's what he means by worse than random.
So how do you go from worse than random to what you just said, that you think most people can be net profitable? Is that through technique or is it through psychology?
Sure. So you have to realize that you have to trade with methodology, not with emotion. Now, when you become really skilled, you might have intuition, which shouldn't be confused with emotion. That's because you have a lot of experience, and consciously or subconsciously, you may see something and it reminds you of something and you think the market's going up. Now, it's not mumbo-jumbo. It's because you've seen it in your past 10 other times and you kind of know at some level and you kind of experienced it. And so you have this instinct to do it, even if you don't connect the reason why. So that interest, I'm not talking about intuition, but I'm talking about the emotional stuff I gave examples about before. So the first thing is you've got to develop a methodology that has some sort of an edge, because if you don't have a methodology that has an edge, there's no reason why you should make money. I mean, there's just absolutely no reason at all. So that's a process of work and discovery. Not everybody's going to come up with something, but that's a starting point. So you have to have that. You have to get rid of emotions by trading from a plan. You've got a methodology. You trade with your plan. you have to have risk management as part of it. So you know, which will usually entail knowing where you're getting out and sticking to it, the discipline to stick to it. So by going from emotional, spur-of-the-moment types of decisions and listening to other people and all this other stuff, which doesn't work and will just end up losing money, you go to where you've developed a well-defined methodology that has an edge, that you have the discipline to stick to, and that is, and part of that methodology is a very rigorous risk management process that assures you won't lose too much on any given trade or beyond a certain amount on an aggregate number of trades. So that's part of the process.
When you go into and start talking about methodology, how do you define that your methodology is actually working and it's not just luck, that you're just having a really lucky streak?
Well, it's not overnight. So first of all, every person got to find their own methodology. You got to go towards things that you feel comfortable with. Some people be comfortable with fundamentals, some people be comfortable with a technical approach. I have one trader in this book who wasn't comfortable with either and came up with a completely different approach. So, but the bottom line is you have to go where you're comfortable and then try, read what you can on it, watch the markets, record experiences, start developing an idea of what would define a reason for you to buy or sell a market, and also what would define you're getting out of that trade. Because if you just decide where to get in, you don't have a process yet. You have to also know where you get out. Now, getting out, you don't have to know where to get out if you're profitable. That you can just kind of, follow the market up and raise a stop or whatever. But you do have to know where you get out when you're wrong. So that's a process of experimenting. And, initially, if people have never traded, I advise they do paper trading, because while it's not the real thing, while it doesn't have the emotions, if you can't make money paper trading, then there's no reason to try it with real money. And if you get to the point where you have a methodology that, and you've tested in paper trading and it seems to work, well, you still have to get past the hurdle of doing it with real money. I would suggest starting with a small amount so it doesn't become, you don't fall into the trap of it being too emotional. And, gradually build up if it's working, I always advise people never to take all their risk capital and to put it in the first time, because most people don't succeed the first time. So you might as well learn your lessons with losing less money. But eventually, if you keep at it and you've come up with some valid approaches, then it can come together. And you have an edge when the market's telling, when your equity curve is telling you have an edge, right? So, your equity curve will be going up gradually over time. That's telling you, with the proviso that you're not doing something that is dependent strictly on the market. So if you are trading stocks and you trade only long from the long side, which is perfectly fine. You don't have to trade the short side. It's difficult. But if you're trading only the long side and you've only been in a bull market and you're doing well, you don't really know anything unless you're doing much better, let's say, than the indexes. Because what you may just be seeing is a reflection of the market, not your skill. So people do have to be careful to make sure they're not kidding themselves that what they're trading, what the underlying market they're trading is not the source of the profits, rather it's their methodology.
Speaking of the equity curve going up, you mentioned in the book that it's harmful to look at consistency and that people shouldn't be looking for straight line performance.
Yeah.
Would you mind talking about that?
Sure. And it wasn't me who said that. It was one of the traders who brought this, who brought that lesson up. And his point, I asked him what are the characteristics of losing traders? And what he said was, ironically, one of the traits and this is a fellow who for a number of years worked in a prop shop, so he saw a lot of traders come and go. And he said one of the things he's noticed about the traders who fall out is that they strive for consistency. Now, that sounds kind of surprising, because you think, hey, isn't consistency good? Well, the problem with consistency in trading, as a result, it's not a problem, but the problem is that's your objective. If your objective is overwhelmed by trying to be consistent, you got to make money every month, because you know, you're using part of your profits to pay your mortgage or something like that. That type of objective of consistency is harmful because the markets don't really care about what you want. And the markets, whatever your approach is, there are times when the markets are going to be very amenable, and there are times when the markets are just not going to give you any good opportunities, or your approach is not going to work very well. But bottom line, the market environments change, and the favorability to your approach can be radically different in different time frames. So you could go through a period where the markets are just not favorable for what you're doing. And if you're driving for consistency, what's going to happen is you're going to take trades that are outside your methodology. You're going to trade larger than you should to make back up some losses. You're going to do all these things that are diversions from what your rules are, and that's going to end up causing you to lose money. So it's kind of ironic, but that striving for consistency can lead to being a losing trader because it will change the way you trade, as opposed to if you're completely objective and followed the methodology exactly. And if there were no trades that fit your approach, you didn't take any trades, which is not easy to do, but if you had the discipline not to take the trades, then you would be better off. So that's what it means, is striving for consistency can itself be detrimental. Of course, the result of consistency is good, but not striving for it as a overreaching objective.
You mentioned markets changing over time. And I think a lot of us have experienced this, you know, high-frequency trading, there's a lot of computer power. In general, people know more about markets now than they did many years ago. And also, you see more, you know, passive inflows, a lot of Robinhood traders, and which result in a very different market dynamic than maybe 10, 20 years ago. Do you think that early market wizards have a very different set of skills than newer ones?
No. You know, the methodologies are always different. And, you know, in any book, the traders have all different methodologies anyway. So it's always different for different people. It's different at different times. There are methodologies which are possible now because of computers, which weren't possible, let's say, 30 years ago. But those are not people will develop whatever their methodology is. What makes traders profitable, those characteristics don't change. I mean, yes, the markets have changed dramatically. We have electronic trading instead of pits. We have tremendous computing power, both in terms of, you know, supercomputers, you know, for those firms that might need that type of processing power, but even down to the simple PC having enormous computing power compared to what existed. In fact, PCs didn't even exist when I did, for the track records that were formed by the original market wizards. I mean, they existed when I did the book, but during their history of trading, a lot of that was pre-PC. So, yeah, there have been enormous changes. And, of course, you have the high-frequency trading, et cetera, et cetera. But the skills that successful traders demonstrate don't change. I mean, risk management was important 30 years ago, it's important 100 years ago, it's important now, it'll be important 50 years from now. So those type of things don't change. The need to be very disciplined doesn't change. The ability to be flexible and whatever your methodology is, if you're wrong, to be able to admit it and get out. And if you see that the opposite side is correct, to even be able to reverse your position, that type of ability is important. These are characteristics and traits. The ability to have patience to wait for the right trades, not to jump the gun. Patience is a difficult trait to have, and I don't particularly have it myself, I would say. So, these things don't change. So the market's changed, but not the characteristics and types of inner skills required to be on the winning side instead of the losing side.
Do you know how many of the older market wizards have stayed with their old tried and true strategies, and how many have had to change over time?
I don't know that as a statistic because in most cases I have maintained contact with people I've interviewed. And even if I did, I wouldn't necessarily have that statistic. But I do know in the process that people, you know, the approach has changed. I need to change because things that used to work can stop working. I've got an example. There's actually one systematic trader in this unknown market wizards book who came into trading. He wasn't a trader by desire originally or anything like that. He was actually a software, you know, developer. And it's through his software.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Where that he got into trading. But once he did, sort of, he used his software skills. And so he's developed many systems over the years, and he keeps every system he ever developed, so he can pull up on his screen instantaneously. We're talking about any system he traded in a given year. He can pull it up. You can see how it did up to when he traded, how it's done since then, and so forth. So now, interestingly, when he started out, he had a group of systems he was trading, and he made money consistently. And then one year, they just stopped. Seemed like they stopped working. They were losing month after month, and he made a decision that the markets have speeded up and he needed to change. He was using the close and he decided that he had to put the trade on before the close. And part of the things he was looking for were volume, let's say. And so he would like anticipate by the partial volume intraday what the ending volume would be and stuff like that. So he switched to that. But what was fascinating was that when he pulled up, I said, well, how are the original systems done, you know, after you stop trading? And it's the most amazing thing. It's sort of like a hill going up, and then he starts going down, he gets out of it. And since that day, it's never made money again. It's lost money every year. So you know, you need to be able to change. That's kind of a dramatic example. But, you know, there's another example in this book of trader who traded events like central bank announcements and stuff. And so at one time, he would be very prepared, very ready, and would have his finger in a mouse, which he still does, but would be ready with that order. So when he heard the central banker say something, he would immediately be able to execute the order. And, it turned out, as more years went by, And the programming became more sophisticated, where now there were programs that could analyze speech and on certain words or phrases coming up could execute quickly. The computer could execute more quickly than the trainer. So he had to change his approach. In fact, in that particular aspect of that type of trade, he went from trying to get in right away, getting the first bird up, to waiting for the first bird to get overdone and going the other way. So people have to adapt to the changing markets.
And for people not adapting, I guess some of them blew up their accounts. And you often hear a lot of stories, sometimes pretty amusing stories. It feels like most successful traders have sometimes in their career blown up their account, or maybe even multiple times, almost like a rite of passage to become a successful trader. Do you think that failure is necessary to become a successful market wizard?
Yes and no. So many, as you know, many of the people I interviewed, even though they're phenomenally successful, blew up once or more times early. So certainly early failure does not foredain long-term failure. That part is certainly. There are some people, though, who were successful from the very beginning. So, it works both ways. Now, the thing about failure, though, is that one common trait among traders, successful traders, is that they place a lot of emphasis on failure and learning from failure. Probably the person who's made the most of it is Ray Dalio from Bridgewater, Bridgewater being the world's largest hedge fund. And he built this whole firm, which when I interviewed him was like 1,000 people or something like that. But he built this firm on a philosophy that you learn from mistakes. And he has this book called Principles, which everybody who joins the firm has to read. And a lot of those principles have to do with learning from failure. The idea is you use failure to improve your process. Okay. And he found that from the very, very beginning of his trading career. So learning from mistakes, and a number of traders that I've, many, many traders I've interviewed, particularly notable in this most recent book, keep diaries of every trade they've done and are very careful to note what went wrong and so that it becomes a learning lesson. I mean, you could say that failure is how traders become better, learning from failure, I should say, is how traders become better traders.
On that topic, what do you think defines a good trader and a great trader? What's the difference?
Well, I think part of it is just some people, I think, have just an innate talent for it. They're just able to hone in on the market in a way that most people aren't. Go back to my own experience beginning of my career. This is way back in the early 70s. When I took Michael Marcus's job, he still was in New York. He left to become a trader. We talked when I was moving in, he was moving out. And we stayed in contact, and we would get together for lunch, every few weeks and so forth. So we kept that contact, and we talked markets, obviously. Now, I remember I was, at that time, one of the markets I covered was cotton, and I was, supposedly a cotton expert, and I did what any economist would do, or economics-trained person would do. So I went through, and I looked at all the markets in that post-World War II period, and I did all my analysis and whatever. And in that particular instance, it turned out that most of the markets had been dominated by government loan programs, so you didn't really have free market equilibrium. So there were only a few markets that were pertinent. But of those markets, I assessed that the current year was like the most bullish of any in the post-World War II period. We were at like about 25 cents then, and I thought we would go back to the highs, the same type of situation of the most bullish market, which was around 33, 34 cents. So and once it got up to there, I kind of thought that the market was getting sort of overdone and would be vulnerable. Well, Mike, I remember speaking to Michael, who didn't do all this analysis, but Michael had the skill to look at 100 different things and know which one was important. And he recognized that that year was the first time the PRC, China, at that time, People's Republic of China, was buying cotton in for the first time, and they were buying in large amounts. And he recognized that that was the key factor. So it's that type of skill. So I looked at everything, but he understood that that was the key factor. And he said, no, Jack, this market's going a lot higher. And, you know, ultimately went to 99 cents. So, you know, he was totally right. I was obviously wrong. I mean, luckily, I didn't have money to, you know, in fact, I went short, I remember, at 33 and didn't have enough money. And luckily, I had so little money, I got stopped out because I didn't have any more funds at 35, fortunately. That's an example. So it's something that he has. It's like an innate skill to be able to identify what is the key factor. So I don't think, that's why I would answer that.
Speaking of your trading, you've written books on fundamental analysis, technical analysis, futures trading. What kind of trading do you do yourself?
Yeah, I ultimately evolved to technical for a long time now. And now really just charts. So all I use is charts, and I just pick, and I'm not a trend trader. I'm not a counter. I can trade with the trend. I can trade counter trend. I'm just looking for, chart points where I think the odds of the market either, going in the same direction or a reversing direction are, in my mind, greater than 50-50. I think it's a spot where the market will either reverse, or when I say spot, I don't mean necessarily an exact set, but if I have a little zone that I expect either the market will reverse, or I believe that the market is, let's say, consolidating and will continue out in the same direction. But if I see some pattern that I think will lead to a next price swing, I will take that trade. I will have a stop in at the same time I put the trade on. And so if I'm right, I'll make, more than I'll lose when I'm wrong. And if I'm wrong, I'm out at a predetermined amount of loss. So basically, I combine chart reading with money management. And my chart reading doesn't necessarily mean classical. I mean, I sometimes will trade opposite a classical pattern because I think, the market has just failed the classical pattern, and that itself is a signal.
What kind of markets and instruments are you trading?
I trade futures mostly. Lately, I've been trading a lot of stocks. Sometimes I'll trade stocks a lot, but usually it's mostly futures. And I will trade options in both those markets as an extra tool. And that's basically it.
If we look at all of the markets wizards you interviewed and all the traders you met as well, do you see more people leaning towards technical analysis, for example?
No, I don't know. It's hard to say. It's not a scientific sample. So I run into people doing fundamentals and technical all the time. So, and sometimes a combination of the two. So I don't know if there's, I would say certainly chart analysis, technical analysis has become much more popular, than it used to be, many decades ago. Where the balance is now, I don't know.
Being a trader yourself and having interviewed, hundreds of very successful traders, what is your take on effective markets?
On what kind of markets?
Yeah, like the efficient market hypothesis?
Yeah, no, I don't think the markets are efficient. In fact, I wrote a book called Market Sense and Nonsense, and I've got an entire chapter of why I don't think they're efficient. So part of those reasons are kind of theoretical reasons or philosophical reasons. And some are just empirical, So, for example, I've interviewed traders who have track records that just are beyond the realm of possibility in terms of markets being efficient. For example, the one I like to use is Ed Thorpe, who maybe is known to most of the world because he wrote his book Beat the Dealer. He's a mathematician, and he developed many He ran two hedge funds. He developed many. He was the originator of many strategies. He actually was the. He actually this kind of worked out the Black-Scholes model in a slightly different format, but equivalent format as the Black-Scholes, many years before they published their famous paper, and was using it to make money. He didn't publicize it, and he did a lot of other things. But anyway, the first hedge fund he ran was 19 years. Yeah, and he had three losing months. He had three losing months in that entire period. And, you know, it turns out those losing months were all less than 1%. So his gains were larger than his losses, obviously. I did a probability calculation on, you know, what it was, you know, I made the simplifying assumption that his gains were equal to his losses, which is conservative because his gains were larger. But that's equivalent to saying, what's the odds of getting 225 heads out of 228 tosses? And that probability is, the number is so small that people can't relate to it. So I came up with an analogy. And the analogy basically is, if you pick an atom in the entire mass of the Earth, and then randomly pick one another atom, randomly, and you end up hitting the same atom, that probability is larger than his record. So you've got empirical proofs of things that are impossible. Then you've got Richard Thaler, who's a famous pioneer of behavioral economics, had this wonderful wonderful example. There's a closed-end fund that had the ticker symbol CUBA, Cuba, which is they hold Central American stocks and maybe South American too, but anyway, the ticker symbol was CUBA. Well, most closed-end funds traded at a discount. We don't need to go on the tangent in this short period. Let's just take that as a given. And like a typical closed-end fund, this was trading at about a 15% discount. Then one day, it went from a 15% discount to a 70% premium. And so what happened? That's extraordinary. That means it goes from the value of its portfolio was trading 15% below the value of its portfolio. Then the next day, it's trading 85% higher than the value of its portfolio. Well, what the hell happened? Well, what happened was that President Obama announced we were going to move towards normalization with Cuba. Now, the funny thing about this is that there are no stocks in Cuba. So obviously they didn't have any holdings in Cuba. And you know, even if there were stocks in Cuba, the law wouldn't have permitted any American company to invest in Cuba. So it was preposterous. Of course, it went back down in like a day or two later. But those type of things tell you that the markets can't possibly be efficient because those are empirical proofs. Like I got many others. But then there's other things like just the reason people get it wrong. People say, well, the theory says everything is known and any new information, everybody has the same information and any new information is instantly known. So how could you possibly get ahead? Well, that's like saying, there's a chess tournament and everybody knows all the rules and everybody has all the chess books. So how could anybody be better? Well, obviously you got people who can crush everybody else because they're just more skilled. It's not that they know something that nobody else knows. It's that they're just more skillful in applying what the knowledge is. Same in markets. And there's many, many others. Like I said, I got a whole chapter on it, but the short answer, no, I don't believe in the efficient market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Offices. Although I should say that the markets act close to like they're efficient. And for people who are not skilled, they would actually be better off investing as if they were efficient. So in other words, for most people who have no skill in the markets, investing and trading, their best decision is probably buying a low-cost index fund and holding it for 30 years, you know, which is the epitome of what you would do if the markets were efficient. So it's kind of ironic. For most people are actually better off acting as if the markets were efficient, even though I think there's incontrovertible proof that the markets are not efficient.
So you don't believe that anyone can take advantage of an inefficient market?
No, you know, and you know why. I'll give you a simple example. One of the reasons for inefficiencies is the thing that's left out of all the mathematical models, because it can't be modeled, is human emotion. And so I use an analogy when I give talks. I put up a recipe for chicken soup, and I got a bunch of ingredients. I ask people, can anybody tell me what ingredient is missing? And the missing ingredient is chicken. And usually somebody spots it. And my point is that the efficient market hypothesis is, you know, is a theory of markets like a chicken soup recipe without the chicken. Well, what's the chicken in the markets? The chicken in the markets is human emotion. So, for example, when you have internet stocks in the late 1990s go up 600%, literally in a year and a half, and then they went all the way back down the next year and a half. But when you have that type of thing happen, well, you could see there are companies that should have no reason trading at anything of value, let alone go from 10 to 200. You could see that, and you could be 100% right, but you can go broke trying to short it. So you can spot a market bubble, but you don't know if the NASDAQ is going to stop at 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000, 5,000 plus where it eventually did, I think, or go to 7,000. You don't know. So you could be right and still lose money. So even though those moves were totally a total classic example of inefficiency, because the market went up six times, went all the way back down, the whole cycle in 3 years with no real big change in fundamentals. It was just a matter of a hysteria on the upside and then a panic on the downside. Oh, well, not so much a panic on the panic, you know, yeah, eventually at the end, but initially it was just a matter of the music stopped, and once it started going, there was no reason for the stocks to be there, so they went all the way back down. So that's why you can have an efficiency, but it may be very difficult to exploit.
Speaking of the late 90s, what is your take on today's market with the SPAC craze, IPOs, and tech stocks without profits and sometimes even without revenue?
Yeah, well, it depends on the individual, depends on this particular situation. I don't think today compares. I don't think you have anything like you had, let's say, in the late 1990s. I don't think it's that type of situation. You can certainly make a case for stock market being highly, highly priced. I mean, that's certainly true. But it's not. I don't think it's necessarily a bubble situation. I think it's more a situation where, theoretically, you could get a correction, but I don't think you'd get a situation where you would go like all the way back down to where we were in March type of thing. So I don't think it's the same type of thing.
We have a question from a listener, a gaming investor, and he asks, how does a trader develop an edge in the market? And how does one distinguish this as a consistent edge against, if it's luck, survivorship bias, or just the current market climate?
Yes. So since everybody has a different methodology, there's a million different ways to come up with it. And there's no formula for it. You know, if anybody's telling it as a formula, I wouldn't believe it. And like I said before, the way you know it, it's over time. Unfortunately, trading is real time. You can't speed it up. I mean, you can do simulations and historical things to see if it worked, but it's still, you have to see it executed in real time, and that's a slow process. So as you're trading, if you're making money, you could build up the commitment to that slowly, but it's just a matter of time.
So for young listeners who are just starting out trading, what's your best advice to them?
Okay. First of all, you have to discover what your approach is. The beginning process would be to read, just, you know, find, you know, look at books, look at lots of market-oriented books and see what seems like it would be interesting and try reading those. Try, you know, you have to discover what area you want to focus on. So there's no way that you can really do that necessarily without at least reading. So it's not like you're reading to necessarily copy somebody, but it's to get ideas. So just reading broadly on different books about markets, different trading, etc., is a beginning process. And then with that background knowledge, watch markets and try to take ideas that you've gotten and experiment and empirically try to develop some sort of method. And once you're ready, like I said, the next step would be try applying it using paper trading, or you can, like, a lot nowadays you can do this electronically and have an account that trades fictitious money, and that's probably the easiest way to do it. It's not the same thing because the emotions aren't there, but at least you could see if the ideas you have work or don't work. If they do work, then start with a small amount of money. And, start, you know, so two things about this, about starting. You start with less than all your risk capital because you don't want to blow it all on your first endeavor, because odds are most people are not going to do well first time around. And second thing is, whatever amount you start with, let's just say somebody starts with $100,000, you want to pick some number where if you lose that amount cumulatively, the day that happens, or the, you know, let's say you do it on a closing basis, the day you, let's say you decide you're willing to risk 20% of that, the day your account closes below $80,000, the next morning you just liquidate everything. So it basically limits you from blowing too much money at one, you know, on the first try. And it also means that if that's been your experience, you're obviously not, you're doing something that's not right. So you might as well go back to the drawing board and do some more work. So, and then once you do start, and if you get ahead by a certain amount, then my advice is bring that type of liquidation point to break even, and eventually to something higher than break even. And just gradually build as you're successful, rather than trying to do what people do out of greed, which is, well, you know, thinking will be, well, I'd rather have more money on because if I'm right, I want to make more money. But that's the wrong way to think about it. The way to think about it is, if you have too much on in the beginning, you greatly increase your odds that you're not going to succeed, that you're going to blow out. So better to start with a smaller amount and gradually build it as you prove you're able to make money in the markets. That's the whole process in a nutshell.
You mentioned books. Do you have any books you would recommend to our listeners?
Well, you know, I'm not going to recant my own out of self-interest, but basically, I mean, I haven't read a lot of market books, but the couple that I would recommend are, which a lot of people I've interviewed have recommended, which is Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, which is a book 100 years old, and the markets are different, but some of the ideas there are classic. For people who, I think just for general risk management and chart kind of information, Peter Brandt wrote a book called, I think, Diary of a Commodity Trader. I forget exactly, but just go with I think in Diary of a Commodity Trader. But he basically noted all his trades for a year, and so you can see how he thinks and how he manages money. So I think that's a good book. Actually, a number traders in my most recent book, even though they were fundamental traders, he still cited Brandt as an influence for the money management factor. There are lots of books that are, you know, good books about markets, not necessarily books that will make you a better trader, but, you know, like, you know, When Genius Failed is a great book about by Lowenstein, a great book about long-term capital. And there are lots of books like that are really good books, but they're not necessary. If your goal is to learn how to trade, those books won't necessarily teach you how to learn how to trade. So, and like I said, I myself, I actually haven't read a lot of, you know, market books. And so it's hard for me to recommend any.
We will put links anyway to the books you mentioned. And we will also, of course, put a link to your books. And I strongly recommend as well to read, especially the first Market Wizards, and of course the new one as well. I think it's especially a good way to, just like you mentioned, to try and find a style that attracts you, basically. So one final closing question that we always ask our guests. What was your best and worst investment, and what have you learned from those experiences?
Okay. So the worst one is hard. There's probably a couple, but I mean, the one that sticks the most in mind is it's a prelude. Well, okay, so there was a point, I don't remember how many years ago, about 5 years ago, roughly, I don't remember exactly, but I had a position in FXI, which is the Chinese ETF, and had it, from earlier on, and sort of had a good, really good profit in it. I wasn't necessarily thought it was a top or anything, but on the other hand, other indexes are going up. And at the time, I thought the retail index seemed kind of high priced. And I saw what I did is I went short an equivalent amount of dollars in the retail index, ETF. So I effectively there was long FXI and short the retail index. And one day, the FXI was down 2% on the same day the retail index was up 2%. Now, the mistake wasn't being in a position. The mistake was what I was long in was the weakest, sector, and what I was short in was the strongest sector. And I knew better, and I kind of certainly noticed it. But the only thing I could have done right at that point was just to take the 4% hit that day, you know, in that combined position. And I procrastinated for about a week or two, and I eventually got out. But that was like the stupidest, worst mistake I can think of, because I knew that you want to be long the strongest, short the weakest. And I was exactly the opposite. I knew enough to know I was on the wrong side. But it was such a big move in one day, both indexes going in opposite direction, which actually, in hindsight, should have been an indicator there was even more reason to get out of it. So that's the kind of – that sticks in my mind as the stupidest, worst trade I can think of. And as far as the best trades probably were back in late 2008. At the end of 2008, I thought we were in a classic panic market. I saw stuff like the FXI – being down 75%, XME, the metals index being down 75%. I kind of thought like, Jesus, and there's basic value here. It's just a matter of time. So, and the time to buy it is when everybody's in the panic. So I was a little early for the exact bottom, but what I did is I bought leaps, you know, leap calls. So so buying calls in the midst of that panic was probably the, because that it worked exactly like I thought, you know, and it did, you know, it made many multiples, obviously. But so that was probably the best trade.
Thanks a lot for meeting us today and being so generous with your time as well.
That was great having you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That was everything from us this week. We sincerely hope that you enjoyed this special edition of Market Makers in English. Just a reminder, this podcast is only for informational purposes and should not be relied upon as basis for investment decisions.
If you're an international listener and like this podcast, please let us know at podcast@marketmakers.se or on Twitter at MarketMakersPod. Who knows? Maybe we'll do another international episode in the future.
Yeah, and please rate us on iTunes and check out our website on marketmakers.se. A link is, of course, in the show notes, as well as all the links that Jack mentioned in the interview. And last but not least, thank you for listening this week.
And have a Merry Christmas.